Hey, welcome to the Protectors Podcast. I am here with Joe Fasanelli. Joe, what's going on, brother?
Same old, my man.
We are in person.
Yes.
In the beautiful Staten Island.
Yes. The forgotten borough.
The forgotten borough. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. You know, I've never been to Staten Island. Now I'm like a veteran of the NYPD. I mean, all over New York, but Staten Island's a different place, man. I like being out here because there is a lot of space. Now, we're at the Trinity Training Complex.
You're correct.
And where did this concept come from?
So this is about, I would like to say it's a few year project, but it's really like almost a 10 year project. We decided on Staten Island for a lot of reasons. Number one, I live here. I was born here, raised here, probably going to die here. The end truth of the matter is that it's the only borough that would kind of even tolerate or maybe even be palatable for this kind of complex. It's typically a red city compared to the rest of, you know, the five boroughs. I consider this the last line of defense when it comes to actual real New Yorkers still being here. That's wind.
Oh, okay. Yeah, guys, this is like, we don't know, guys, but you know what's really cool about this is doing an in-person podcast is – it's real, man.
It's as real as you get.
This isn't like Zoom. This isn't StreamYard and all the other stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But you started off in the PD, right?
Yeah, so I started off in NYPD. I got on the job in July of 04. Spent about a little under 13 years there. And then back in 2016, I flipped over to under DHS. And it was time. Kind of everything kind of happened for a reason. I was always looking for a Fed job, even when I first got on this job. Prior to it, I was an intern at Secret Service. So I had post 9/11, I joined the Marine Corps. Went from the Marine Corps pretty much in my junior, senior year of college. Finished my undergrad, and I was doing the reserve thing. I had gotten my internship with Secret Service down on Adams Street in Brooklyn with the hopes of never touching a PD uniform, but just going right into federal work. And unfortunately, I didn't have enough work experience. They liked that I had military, but they didn't really, you know, I had nothing really to hang my hat on because I was just a college kid. They said, go into the PD for a little bit, a year or two, get cut your teeth a little bit and then come on over. And that was kind of like my plan. And then got into the police department that July. I graduated college that May, got into the police department in July of 04. Immediately got out to the 61st precinct, which is in Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn. Was doing that for a little bit and I got activated with the military. So I did my deployment with the Marine Corps, went to Fallujah in 2006. Came back, and during my transition back to like PD life, I actually was taking like a intro to, you know, bomb awareness or some bullshit class. And the guy that was in the class was showing really antiquated pictures. And I said, hey, you know, I just left Iraq. I said, I have these cool, like this cool, you know, file of like all different things that we uncovered while I was there. I said, let me give it to you. So I hand it to him. And the very next day he goes, hey man, I went through that thumb drive. He goes, that's some seriously cool stuff. Like where is this from? I said, I only left the country like not even 90 days ago. I'm like literally just fresh out of Fallujah. I said, and I was working with an intel team that had, you know, carte blanche to all different types of evidence. So I could kind of picked and chose and always took stuff in because I thought it was just, you know, I'm going to want to look back on this stuff one day. And in doing so, he goes, hey, man, I like what you've been through. I like where you've been. I like what you're going through. And I think you have some value maybe with a friend of mine. Let me introduce you to this guy. So Richie, the bomb guy, the bomb tech, he introduces me to this guy, Ed Sloan. Ed is, unbeknownst to me at the time, a first grade detective, which I didn't even know the difference. I was so boot on the job, I didn't realize what the value of a first grader was. Like a first grader is like, you know, high on the totem pole. Like there's very few of them. And he introduces me to Ed, and Ed's sitting down with another guy, Pete, and they say, hey, we want to talk to you. So they invite me to the counterterrorism division, which is in Coney Island, Brooklyn. And I go and I sat there and they put me in this library and I sat down with Ed and Pete and they just talked much like we're talking now. And over the course of the conversation, eventually he goes, hey, you know, I like some of the experiences you've been through and we don't want to put that to good use, but understand that this is a very passive unit. Like we don't kick indoors. We don't, none of that happens, but the terrorism value is there. So would you be interested in maybe applying for counterterrorism division? And I was like, well, I mean, doesn't everybody want to be here? It's post 9/11. Yeah. The unit's brand new. It's sexy. It's hot. It's super funded.
Funded.
You know, of course I wanted to. I was a patrol cop. He goes, look, I'm just a detective, but let me see what I could do. I'll put in a good word. I said, well, I appreciate that. So fast forward about a month, maybe 2 months. I'm actually in the middle of a trial prep for a homicide. I found a gun that was killed a guy. They hit it on top of an elevator and I recovered it. So I was a piece of the evidence chain for the detectives that were, you know, doing the enhancement. And I'm in the middle of that. And I'm upstairs with the squad and I'm like, you know, completely unrelated to anything terrorism or any, you know, transfers or anything like that. And the boss down on the desk is like, hey, come downstairs. So immediately I think I'm in trouble because I'm like, there's no way I'm getting called down to the desk for anything good. And I get down there and the lieutenant down there was actually a good dude. I used to drive him a lot. He's like, hey, come over here. So I go behind the desk because I would never go behind the desk because back in the days we had respect for our bosses. And he's like, come here. And he's pointing at the telephone message log. I'm like, what? I don't even know what the fuck this is. You know? So I look into it and it says, as of midnight hours, you know, PO Fasanella transferred to counterterrorism division. So I'm looking at it. I'm looking at him. He's looking at me. He's like, he goes, oh, you can go away now. I'm like, oh, okay. So I thought he was going to say something, you know? And I go back up to the squad and the detective's looking at me like, you all right? Are you in trouble? I'm like, yeah. I said, I'm good. And I said, I'm actually transferred. I'm done. I said, I can't even do the trial. I said, I'm transferring as of midnight hours tonight. I had no idea what the hell that meant. They're like, to where? I'm like, counterterrorism division. And everything just stops. They're like, fuck the case. That's the thing. All of a sudden they're pulling like, you know, little bottles out from their bags and stuff like that. Hey, you stepped in shit, kid, and have a drink. And I'm like, whoa. I'm like, this is another side of the department I've never seen, you know? So it's cool. It was like, you know, it was pretty much wet behind the ears. And here I am, this like super junior dude transferring to a very senior unit. And it was nothing but trials and tribulations. I spent the first probably 2 years just trying to figure out my place amongst really seasoned people. Like we had, you know, the proverbial first grade detectives, guys who were, you know, cut their teeth in, you know, organized crime, making names for themselves in narcotics and all these things. And then you have this like white shield mixed in amongst it. And it's like, well, where do you fit in this whole thing? Well, my question was, well, where do you guys fit in this whole thing? Like, you know, why are you here? You know, are you just hanging your hat on the fact that you were this, that, the other? Like, you know, we're doing terrorism work, which pre 9/11 really didn't exist. And now this unit is just boom. Mm-hmm. I come to find out that the guy that kind of vouched for me, the guy Ed, was a naval intelligence officer. He had spent a lot of time in Cuba, doing Gitmo stuff. And he was one of the people that they valued as someone who knows a little thing or two, and he can kind of read between the lines when they're interviewing people. And that's kind of how I got in. So I ended up getting transferred. I didn't go right to the division. I ended up going to a little offshoot, which was Office of Emergency Management. So it was a little offshoot down in Cabin Plaza, down by the Brooklyn Bridge. And I was fucking miserable. It was the worst, the worst thing I ever did. But in retrospect, if I was an 18-year veteran, it would have been awesome because it was like the place you go to die. Yeah. But with 3 years, 4 years on the job, I was like, this is not really where I want to be. So I was begging, you know, clawing my way back to the division to get back to terrorism stuff. But needless to say, I'd spent about a year there. I was doing like watch control, watch command, which was kind of like you have your finger on the pulse of everything that goes on. So every agency has a representative in that building. So I learned a little bit of interagency work. And I spent my year just basically watching things unfold in real time. So I had the papal visit. We had the crash in the Hudson. So these are all things that I was I lived through. And in retrospect, I'm like, wow, these are really notable events. But at the time, it didn't really mean much of anything to me because New York, that happens, stuff like that happens all the time. I'd say on any given day back then, it was just wild.
New York is so big, man. There was like 40,000 officers.
So when I got on the job, there was about 38,000. Okay. We're nowhere near that.
No.
Yeah, we'll go. That's a bone of contention. We are, you know, there's been a mass exodus because most of the hiring was right after 9/11. So our numbers pre 9/11 were smaller. Then we bumped up, you know, with funding and all this other stuff. And in the post 9/11 push, when people actually wanted to be a cop. And then I'd say for me, I saw the transition of people starting to say, let me look elsewhere, was probably around the time of like the Sean Bell shooting, which was the first time I had ever experienced like riots.
Yeah.
And then that kept happening. Then it was Occupy Wall Street and Zuccotti Park.
I forgot about like the
Occupy. Like these things were like great. These things were happening. And like what would be a small pocket of resistance would turn into bigger and bigger. And then eventually to what we see now today. So I think I'd like to say that it's kind of started with that.
And when did you make the jumps to the feds?
2016.
Okay.
So I left in 16.
So you had a decent amount. Were you doing terrorism all the way up until then?
Yeah, from about 3 years on, right up until the end.
Okay.
And that's
kind of... Now, did you get your way back to the division? Or?
So I made my way to the division. I eventually spent about 8 years in the Seaburn team, so doing Ken Bio, Rad Nuke, and Explosives. Okay. And that's kind of where I learned a lot of cool stuff. So my first project was I was overseeing the suicide bomber interdiction team. So we had some technology that came in from Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I was basically handed like a $500,000 machine and said, hey, the Israelis are going to come teach you how to use this, figure out how to implement it. It was like a crash course and how to like set up photography. It was like a big camera that was on a gimbal mount. I have no idea. I'm a knuckle dragon Marine at the time. So I had those crazy stuff and like, they're like, don't drop the lens. The lens alone is 50 grand. And I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, how many do we have of these? Like four. I'm like, oh my God. Like, and I'm responsible for this. So I was freaking out.
Uh-huh.
And that turned into bigger and bigger stuff. And we basically would, the division has like this unlimited budget, right? They have the account. Mm-hmm. And all the money goes through the division. So even other units benefited from counterterrorism having this one-way, you know, two-way street with the federal budget. And it was constantly flexed. You know, people always, you know, oh, we need to kiss the ring of counterterrorism czar to make sure we get this unit, that truck, this, that, that. So we had a lot of cool equipment. We had a lot of cool training. You know, it wasn't uncommon that, like, you know, you'd be getting an email in the morning like, oh, Dr. Jane Oxley from Harvard is in town, you know, blah, 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 blah. She's going to be doing a class on, you know, improvised explosives.
Well, think about it. New York is like the epitome of counterterrorism, man. And when you talk about the budget and you being on that unit as a junior officer, it's just amazing. That's where, like, I can imagine your experience bringing it into the Fed world. But not also that, but everything that happened since then, you know, with understanding the realities of what you need realistically to mount a counterterrorism operation, but also to be able to deal with like a stressful environment. Like when you say you're dealing with this hundreds of thousands of dollars of equipment, you also have to think about, okay, I'm like, if you drop this, that's responsibility, man.
Yeah.
But then when you get into like, okay, well, it's not just the equipment. It's like, what does it do?
Right.
How does it do it?
You
have to be super, you can't just be a knuckle dragger anymore.
For sure. For sure.
So you have to understand.
That camera sees heat. So you're 98.6 degrees roughly. That camera has the ability to cool down, let's just say arbitrarily, like -300. So any change in heat that's coming out off your body or something that's blocking heat from coming off your body gets silhouetted as a thermal anomaly. And that's how we determine, all right, is that person concealing something below their clothes? The trials and tribulations of stopping people for those few, you know, years that we were kind of getting the system up and running and trying to figure out how to get it, that was great. That's gray area stuff, which is going to tie into why the company's called Condition, my initial company was called Condition Gray, because terrorism work at the time was neither black nor white, because we were still kind of figuring it out. Post 9/11 policing is very different than pre 9/11 policing. I won't pretend to explain that I even understand what a 90s cop went through in New York, because that was some crazy friggin' times. But I also can't imagine a 90s cop ever fathoming what's happened post 9/11. You know, if they had retired and saw that, I mean, we're dealing some crazy stuff. And there's no shortage. I say this all the time. There's no shortage of assholes out there. The activity post 9/11 was just as rampant as it was pre 9/11. I think we were just more open to looking for it. I think JTTF and units like that, they really had their hands full. And there's a lot of interagency issues too. Like between, at the time, I remember it was like counterterrorism, JTTF, Intel Division. Now, I think since I've left the job, they've merged. And, you know, like it's, you know, there's a lot of like weird, you know.
Well, now that's the other thing too. Now you're in the Fed world, you understand the Fed bureaucracy.
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we're not going to, I don't really want to get into too much about what your current Fed job is with the FAMS and everything, because I understand the implications of that. But I can understand leaving such a big agency to go work for the feds.
100%.
I can understand wanting to do something different, something that's not going to limit you, and something's going to give you more of a budget.
For sure.
And you're not, you know, and I'd imagine 13 years on a job, you're going to have some sort of guilt of leaving.
Yeah.
I'm 13 years, I'm vested. Do I leave? What was that taking that step like?
And it was a little easier for a guy like myself at the time, because I had pretty much burnt my bridges in the division. I had a issue with a boss who, really the best thing that ever happened to me was he jammed me up. You know, he came in late in my career and I was still a white shield who was young on the job, but also senior in the unit. That was kind of an anomaly. There was only a handful of us that had probably less than 10 years on. And we happened to be this now senior people in the unit. So you get this young hotshot boss. He kind of came in with a little bit of a, you know, I'm gonna do things my way. But reality is in that a unit like that, bosses were only really good for like overtime slips and days off. Yeah. You know, like it's, I don't really need you for the actual expert stuff because you're not really much of anything. And this guy, I actually started out liking him. And I thought we had a little bit of rapport, but when everything, when push came to shove, he actually tried to jam me up for military paperwork. So he screwed himself. It led to a federal case, and the rest is kind of
never mess with the Fed for another day. Yeah,
it's a Department of Labor case for another day.
The Fed, the military deployments, and stuff like that.
Yeah, so he went the wrong way about it, and it gave me, when everything was said and done, it gave me the ability to kind of choose what I want to do in my life. And at the time, I could have went back to the job, but I had this federal offer. And I literally was on military leave. I came back from military leave. I came back to the job for one day, vested out. And by, I was on a Thursday. And the funny thing is about NYPD, like, there's no ceremony. Like, unless you're like a white shirt, you know, big time chief. But at the time, I was married. And my ex and I, we went up to 1PP to turn in my stuff. And at the time, there was a guy who was being federally indicted, who was a chief, who was being indicted because of some scandal that happened with licensing division, which is kind of ironic that I have the CCW kind of foothold now. But ironically, he's getting a walkout, even though he's going to jail or going to do some time or whatever the heck was going on with his life. He was under the watchful eye of the federal government. So this guy's getting a full walkout, full ceremony, you know, people standing and saluting. And here I am, a cop in good standing. And you know what I got? I got to go up to this half barn door where they put a pillow up, and the little pillow has like a little bit of like gold trim, and it says, you know, congratulations on your retirement. And you put your shield down on it, and they go, oh, thank you for your service. There's cookies and coffee in the next room. And this minute you turn around, you know what you hear?
Clank.
Clank. They're throwing it into a box with every other fucking cop. And my wife at the time, she looked at me and she goes, that's it? I said, yeah, that's it. And she's like, I said, that's it. This is the job. She's like, you killed yourself for this place. You gave your best years to this place. I said, on to bigger and better things. And sure as shit. Eventually, I would, that following Tuesday, I was in my New York field office doing my, you know, initiation. And I remember I hit 3 hours of traffic that day because my office was in Queens. And I remember driving home going, fuck, I shouldn't have done this. I can't stand traffic. Like it's the bane of my existence in New York, you know? But I go into the academy. I kept my mouth shut, kept my ears open, because now I'm an older dude going through a federal academy, and just don't show your cards.
Yeah.
And little by little, I try to say, hey, where'd you work? I worked at NYPD. Yeah, but you could shoot. Yeah, so? Nah, you guys are not known for that. I train on the outside. Oh, what kind of training? Oh, I have a company. Oh, what do? I own this company called Condition Gray. What is that? You know, immediately the next day they come in, they're like, hey man, I've seen your products before. Okay. All right. So by the time I left the academy, the bag was out. They would try to throw me all sorts of curveballs just for fun. And, I'm going to navigate them. I've been through, seen a lot of cool things over my life and navigated a lot of weird stuff. Life was good. So I graduate, I get to my field office, right just prior to COVID, I was selected to do work on Viper, which is like our kind of like our ground team, which is kind of still kind of in its figuring it out kind of stage. It's kind of a weird unit. But then this day, nobody wanted to go up there. I wanted a little break from flying. I was having issues with my ex, which would eventually lead to a divorce. And I joined Viper. And Viper was supposed to be like a 2-year stint. And 2 years, because COVID, turned into 3, which turned into almost 4. And then in that time, the agency had a lot of, I think, interesting dynamics. We were being used for more things. I ended up going to the DC riots, some riots in other parts of the country, riots in my own home city.
I'm seeing people at the border, all over the place.
Border was in, that's a whole debacle. I was just there. border was interesting. What else? NSSEs.
Let's backtrack. You mentioned that you started the company.
Yeah.
Now, where did this all start? I mean, like,
it started because when I was jammed up, so I get jammed up and I get booted from counterterrorism because I have to go, you know, rubber gun squad, so to speak. And I get sent to central booking, which is where we were talking about with Aaron. And I spend a few months there. And in that time, while I'm waiting for my case to kind of fall into place, you know, I'm fighting with, you know, lawyers and, you know, the PBA, you know, trying to figure out how to get back to work, back to doing the real work. And in that time, there was a point where I was like, well, what if I don't? What if I can't get back to it? What I just spent, you know, a good portion of my life establishing these skills that very few cops have. How do I, what if this job, what if I don't have a job when this is said and done? So I was kind of like, oh man, let me take some money out. Let me establish something. So I start investing in myself. I start seeking schools that I knew I could go to. And I end up going, like, I self-paid my way through Darcy Level 1, Darcy Level 2, and all these shooting courses. And I said, let me see what's out there. Let me, how would I structure this if I was to do this here? Because there was nobody out here. And I come back, and in that time, while I'm at Darcy, I had an incident where I went to go dip out of a car under Nods, and my sling got caught around the seatbelt because my rubber band failed. So check that in the back of the box, because we're going to circle back to that. And I finished the drill, and I was completely humbled by that course. That course is an absolute kick in the nuts. Like, if you think you have any understanding of, like, close quarters combat, go there and then figure out if you really do. Because by Wednesday, I was like, my head was like in between my legs and my tail was tucked. I was like, man, this is an ass kicker. But it was a good ass kicker because it opened up my eyes to, as Richard put it, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And we, you know, we have this like King Kong theory in New York where we're the NYPD, we're the biggest, we're the best. We have this, we have that. We're still so far behind. And I'll get to that. So Condition Gray opens. I don't even know if I was legally allowed to have it in the eyes of the NYPD at the time. I didn't give a fuck, which is pretty much my attitude going forward with the job. And
well, you have to have an outlet. You have, it's not just an outlet. You have to have an out.
For sure.
You know, like when I was going through the Fed and I was having some issues there, I had like five or six different things. I'm like, if A happens, I'm going to do B.
Yeah.
B happens, I'm going to do C. And I got to go back to A, I'll go back to A. So
sometimes you got to take a few steps back to go forward. And there's like this unrelenting like grasp that like policing has over you. Like, oh, what? I can't do anything else. You absolutely can do everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I laugh because I think like 3-year cops not seeking a Fed job are out of their minds. They are out of their minds. Because in those 3 years, you're going to put your hands on more people and interact with more people than you, any Fed will. You know that.
Yeah.
You know, it's my, if you saw my two sets of handcuffs, and I wasn't even like this like super active cop, but like my Fed cuffs and like my NYPD cuffs are like, one's pristine. You could tell they've only been used in like a training environment.
Yeah.
And the other ones are like, there's like probably DNA on it still. Uh-huh. Like you could probably like set like an archaeological dig on them. They're just nasty.
Well, my philosophy too is like, treat it like a military enlistment.
Yeah.
You want to serve, go become a cop for 4 or 5 years. You don't have to do a career, man.
Right. Right. Go move on. You know, and it pays off. And I find that like NYPD is funny. Like, so the few guys that were coming on my job, I would sit on the panel and I knew that they were coming in or knew they were coming into a panel interview. I'd be like, how'd they do? And they're like, oh, they did terrible. And I'm like, why? They're like, they wouldn't answer the questions with them. They would only answer the questions with we. I'm like, because that's the we is all they got. I said, it's programmed that, you know, the big blue, you know, wall's coming. It's coming to, you know, back you up. And like, NYPD was good about that. And I think a lot of these guys have a hard time individualizing themselves as something beyond the team.
Yeah.
So they come on the panel interviews and they botch the questions because the person on the panel is like, no, tell me what you did. I don't care what you guys did. I want to know what you did. And that's kind of an issue. So we actually started doing a couple of years ago, we would do federal job like workshops to kind of tell guys, hey, how do you navigate these? Because it took me forever to get a job. I went through the bureau. I went through DEA. I went through all these different things. And it took me 100 tries before I finally got the job I wanted. And, you know, like anything else, like the stars have to kind of align. Like you have to fit the right, you know, what they want for that hiring process. Let's just put it that way, you know, for lack of better words. You know, they may need a
counselor. Well, the feds are hemorrhaging now too. Because I was I retired March, but, you know, I went in 2000 and 2001 was a huge push. That's when I became a special agent of customs back then. But now everybody's retired. And now trying to find people.
Qualified applicants.
Qualified applicants.
Yeah, they let them all go over the past 10 years.
Yeah. And, you know, growing up on the East Coast, you know, because I grew up in Jersey, and it was like everybody wanted to be a cop. Mm. I talked to another captain the other day, and he was like, you know, we used to get like – we had an hiring announcement. We had 800 people. Mm. Now we're lucky if we get 80 or 90. Oh, and then out of that, we're lucky if we can get a handful that can make it through the process.
Right.
So then it comes down to, like, the quality of people you're getting is a lot different. But in there is quality.
For sure.
And then we have to look at the big picture is because they're such big agencies. And I always thought, I'm like, hey, you're NYPD. You're going to be able to go to training and this and that. But no.
No.
You're in these small departments. You're not going to get training. You're lucky if you get to qual with 50 rounds or more.
Right.
You're lucky.
Right.
And there's just simply no training.
Right.
Use of force. Good luck with that.
Yeah. That's
training ammo. Good luck with that. Blue force training or anything. Good luck with that. So you get into the gear, but then when do you start doing the training?
So training started in 2015. My very first class, it's ironic, it was a night vision class because I was hot off the Darcy, the Darcy grad. And I was like, I'm going to bring this and that's going to bring everyone in. And my first night vision class was down at South Jersey Shooting Club and we failed it. But man, the skills were all over the place. There were people that just have gear, just to have gear. And then there were people that were good to go. But for the most part, it was a hodgepodge mix of people. And what I realized was that before we can start doing stuff like that, we have to kind of solidify the fact that people need to have good weapons manipulations. So we kind of took a step back and said, all right, well, what do we need to build people up so they could take classes like that? And the answer was we need to do basic pistol, basic rifle. And we just loaded the schedule for years, probably like 2 or 3 years to build up enough alumni just so that when you do a specialty class, you have that certain caliber of student who can step in and not, you know, jeopardize the safety of the class because it's different out here. We're not born with guns in our, you know, granddaddy's rifle. Weapon safety is kind of a thing that's kind of implemented as they kind of fall into their own.
You know, you just brought up a great point is like, you think about how many cops, how many feds, how many everything live within this, like, these square miles.
Huge.
And like the laws and everything don't make it conducive to go and get even ammo to train on your own.
No, not at
or
all.
Or do this or find a range that you could do, not just like a flat range. Nothing dynamic at all. If anything, you're just shooting paper once in a while.
No, unless you're doing competitions, you ain't moving with a gun anywhere on any of these ranges. And they're just small. I mean, we're lucky in Staten Island, we have a couple of really nice ranges, but you're still dealing with antiquated mindset that you have older range officers who are dealing with a younger generation who's now like a GWAT level or era person who wants to be dynamic, shoot from a holster. And that's part of their job maybe. And they're like freaking out about that. Oh, easy there, fella. Can't do a rhythm.
Well, you get that at
six round body.
Well, think about this too.
Rhythm drill, you get yelled at, you know.
Big departments too, or even little ones. A lot of times the range guys are like,
Old school. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, and they still had revolvers.
Yeah. I think that we're getting past that now. But there was a point where, like, whew, you know, if you were shooting quick, they're like, oh, I can't do that.
So tell us about this complex.
So this place is.
And you showed me around. I'm seriously impressed.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I love this place. It's kind of like an extension of my brain, which is kind of sad to say because it's so weird, but it's definitely me. So one of my students, Bob, who's now my business partner, at one point about 4 or 5 years ago, he's like, hey man, where are you going with all this? I said, I have no idea. He's like, you gotta have something in mind. I said, well, he's like, what's the end state of doing classes and putting out products? I said, well, I guess to retire and have something, you know, always have a back, you know, fallback, you know, dad got kids, got college, you know, and then they're young. I know I needed to do something. He's like, well, in a perfect world, what would you want? I said, well, I'd want a facility that I could do everything, you know, indoor live fire, CQB, night vision, whatever. If you know, sky's the limit. He goes, all right, where would you put it? So we spent about the first year looking in like Pennsylvania for large plots of land. Then we all was like, it's too far. We were losing all our weekends, you know, with our kids and stuff. So then it was Jersey. And then that was still kind of far. And the gun laws are weird and things were changing. And then we were looking into Long Island, and I was like, well, fuck Long Island because I hate the Bell Parkway. And eventually I told him with a straight face, I said, I want to be in the city. He's like, where? I said, Staten Island. He's like, well, that's convenient. I said, yeah, it is. I said, because we have three ranges here. We have a red leading, clientele who are kind of pro-gun, pro-cop, and pro-military. I said, like, honestly, like the last real New Yorkers left. I said, everyone else is like transients. Mm-hmm. Even after COVID, you still got that transient community of people that are coming out from, like, you know, God knows where to try to make their name here. And, you know, I think, like, when you're in Staten Island, you're dealing with actual real New Yorkers. Like, there's a different vibe when you go to, like, a local store. Like, you can kind of feel it, you know. And so I told him Staten Island. And then that started about a year more of just looking at building after building. And the prices here are astronomical. If I told you my overhead for this building, you'd fall off your chair. But it had to be built. It's like, if you build it, they will come. So fast forward to last July, we found this complex. I passed this building 50 times in our search. But this building was in mid reconstruction. And at the point where we were just about to give up, this place finally came available. So we came, we looked at it, because we were looking at another spot down the block, and it was a lot smaller. But then we got offered this one, and we're like, you know what? Fuck it, let's take it. So we go, we walk the property. Everything was, as you kind of see it now, but just wide open. And it was off to the drawing board. Like, well, what's the aesthetic? I want New York. I said, I want to feel New York. I want to walk in here and say, all right, that's the grind of a New Yorker. So we got this graffiti artist who, me, him, and another staffer, good kid, Frank, we decided to go to Manhattan, and we went to, like, you know, Lower East Side, where, like, some of the coolest art is, you know, where people are literally tagging up everything under the sun. And we spent the entire day drinking and looking at graffiti, eating ice cream, eating food, and, like, eating Cuban food. Like, we made a day of it. And we just went from place to place taking pictures. Like, oh, I love that. I love that. I love that. And then we came back and we kind of set up a read book, and we were like, all right, well, this is the graffiti we want to bring here. And that's kind of how it came to be, but then with tweaks. So, you know, you'll see places in there like, oh, it's the pink houses. The pink houses.
Yeah, so for the people who are listening to this, there's actually a room that has, like, just incredible graffiti everywhere.
Right.
It's not just cop-centric, too. I mean, you got Biggie in there. You got, like, everybody you can imagine.
Well, we went to Staten Island, so you have that Wu-Tang.
It's like, cool.
You can't grow up here without at least listening to one song, knowing at least one song by heart. But there's references in there. So, like, you know, my first field office was next to Queensbridge. So when we first go to do ops, that's our homage to that. The pink houses, I had bricks thrown at me on the roof because I was sitting on top of a fire department building doing counter gun stuff with that same system I was telling you about earlier. So the pink houses, I never worked in a 7-5. It was the first time I've ever been there. It was like a mythical place for me because I was a Brooklyn South guy. And then I was like, oh, we're going to the Brooklyn North to do this. And I'm like, ooh, it sounds scary. It's funny because I got a cop, really good friends with, that's he's a housing cop. He's like, you were on top of that?
Ugh.
It's like, why? I'm like, I don't know. Because it sounded like a good idea at the time. The city's wild. It's definitely worse than it's ever been now. And that kind of, this place is kind of like an answer to, well, if the job's not going to give you the training and there's no resource for you elsewhere, what do you have?
Now, where are you bringing in the instructors from?
A lot of them came with me over from Condition Gray.
Okay.
Because they were tried, true, and tested. We're a funny place, so we shoot for our job. In other words, if you come, when you want to work on our staff in any capacity that you're going to touch a firearm, you have to shoot first. Because everybody here has these tremendous resumes. And it's just, you know, 10 pages of just, you know, I love me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You're going to go with my director of training, who's he's a shooter. He's a motherfucker of a shooter. And you're going to go with him and you're going to shoot for your job. Do I want you to shoot like him? No, not everyone can. I can't. But you should be pretty close, because if you're going to step in front of a crowd of your peers, they should look at you and say, well, that's where I can get to. And if you can't do that, I can't just hang your resume on the target. You have to be able to show it. And I think that has created animosity, because people are like, oh, well, I don't want to shoot for my job. Then you don't need to work for us. There's plenty of other companies, go follow. And I'm okay with that. That term comes from my current job, because the early post 9/11 agency was, hey, you want to come work for us? Come shoot for your job. And they had two buses. And, you know, we always get told the story, the lineage of how the service was created. And it's like, there's two buses, one for those who passed and went on to training, and one that went back to whatever job they came from. I always thought that was impressive. And when you look around the industry, some of these people are still in the industry, you know, because they've left my agency and now they're on their own and they're doing their things. And my original staff shirts were burgundy and maroon for my the people who've been with me the longest, because that's a homage to those instructors. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of we never do anything that's like unpurposeful, so to speak, if that's even a word. There's always like a hidden agenda behind it, like, oh, why do they wear that color? Well, also for instructors who have been with me since day one, because they shot for their jobs. And we have some sick instructors on our staff.
Well, that's the thing too, is like, yeah, when you brought up the resume, especially when it comes to firearms and tactical,
yeah,
you could be former whatever, and you might not be a good instructor.
It's true.
You could shoot the whatever,
right?
But to be able to shoot and instruct,
sure,
it's a tough,
for sure. And like, tough thing. New Yorkers are like tough people, like to like impress. Mm-hmm. Like you could outshoot the shit out of them, they'd be like, yeah, he's good.
Yeah, whatever.
He's good. Like, it's like the guy just freaking, you know, crushed the drill. Like, give him credit where credit is due. That guy's good. You know, whatever. That's just New York, the New York mantra. But we've established ourselves. I'm sure we have people that love us. We have people that hate us.
There's always going to be haters. You could be the best company in the world, but I don't know if it's ego or envy or just unknowing.
For sure.
A lot of it is unknowing because they don't know what goes on behind the doors.
For sure.
Now, Trinity, I love that word. I love it. It's so cool. But also, what's your vision now?
To stay alive. So we opened the doors quietly. We didn't know if we were going to have protesters outside our front door. We didn't push it. We didn't like advertise it. We just said, let's let the doors breathe and see what walks in. And we've survived. We actually just hit a year this year that we've been in this building. November would be really a year since we've been open, but we've had a crazy year. So in the past, since November, so however many months that is, we've had close to 800 students for just CCW alone. So basically July, we take over the building. August, we start construction. September, this crazy thing called the Bruin case, all of a sudden just emerges out of nowhere. We knew it was coming, but we didn't know what the outcome of it was. And it just changed the dynamic of what we were intending to do, because the goal was to train law enforcement, military, because that's really all we had. Mm-hmm. And just continued the condition gray model. And now you have this variable that comes out of the blue with the Bruin case. And now 18 million people in the five boroughs can now own a firearm. So where do you go? Well, thank the gods. One of the prerequisites or one of the aspects of CCW is that you can have any type of striker fired munition to include NLTA, which is what this facility is. So you can do you could satisfy the needs of the New York State, mm-hmm, you know, DCJS, whatever cert it is, whatever the requirements are, with sim munitions, force, mm-hmm, on force, UTM, because those are striker fired munitions. So now in the safety of this building, you can do your qual and take your class all under one roof.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where does that leave us? What is my future? Well, we have 800 people. Probably by November, we'll have over 1,000. So that's 1,000 CCW holders who are in the myriad of different aspects of their process. Some who have already received their permit, some who are still on the cusp of it. And then they're going to get it. And with the hopes that they say, you know what? It didn't end there. It just started there. Where, mm-hmm, do I go to train? Now I think the fruits of our labor are going to come.
Well, then you have all their friends and family who want to get CCW.
Exactly.
And you know what? Exactly. You brought up something before about being red.
Yeah.
I can tell you right now that red, blue, green, purple, everybody wants a CCW.
100%.
Everybody.
100%. These classes.
And nobody care. You go in there and you're going to see like a grandma.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to see like a 20-year-old kid with pink hair.
Jason, it's so diverse. It's ridiculous. Yeah. I kind of wish like people would see. No one wants to get videoed in CCW.
No.
And we always ask, like, hey, is everyone uncomfortable, mm-hmm, before we do it? We could really advertise the shit out of it and make, mm-hmm, probably double our profits. But we kind of keep it like, hey, this is where you come. We got you. Word of mouth is fine.
Yeah.
When I tell you the diversity that walks into this building, some of it's fun because they tell you why, mm-hmm, they're here. And some of them be like, well, in my country, before I became a U.S. citizen, we couldn't own firearms. And there was all this turmoil. But here you can. So is that not like the perfect?
That's the Second Amendment.
No, like you came here because you fled a country that couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And now you're here and now you're exercising that right because you can.
Holy shit. And it's not just, you're finding people that don't look at a firearm as a devil anymore.
Right.
They look at it as like, okay, it's fun.
Yeah.
When that's why I'm so big into telling people to get into shooting sports, sure, because it's like,
for sure.
Listen, I'm training just to shoot and time and move, and right, it's fun. You're competing against other people.
Get outside. Right. So we have, if you haven't noticed when you pulled in, we're wedged in between a gymnastics, a very, very lucrative gymnastics gym. So it's nothing but, you know, moms in yoga pants all day. And then we're wedged in behind cheerleading. So we have all these moms that when we first opened, they were like, is this place safe? Are the bullets going to come through the wall? We had to deal with that. And there is this misconception that the only people that own guns in America are, you know, middle-aged white guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you look at our clientele, it's women, young, old, everything in between, every color under the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now we've become palatable to the neighbors. They have no issue with us. And in fact, some of them have come through for CCW. Some of them take training. Some of them have done home defense. Some of them have done live fire classes out in Long Island with us. So I think that we're softening the blow. I think that if we had came hard out the gate prior to the opening and really screamed from the rafters that we existed, I think we would have been shut down. But we, of course, we've kind of like slowly kind of eased into it. I think we become, you know, at first those are the gun guys.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's Joe and Bob. I think we're more acceptable.
Reminds me
now.
Of something like, you know, you're sewing classes.
I do, yeah.
Now that's something that's like me. Like I learned to sew when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And you know, when you're in the military, you have to sew.
For sure.
Because you're always ripping shit.
For sure.
Put buttons. Well, I'm sure. I don't think they use buttons. But anyway, you're always sewing. But what's up? And like the gear, man, everybody loves gear. And let's talk sewing, man. Let's talk into these different types of classes, not just shooting.
If I could have my way right now, I would just sit in the sew shop all day. I could sit there and build anything. I love it. So gear. So I came out of that course I was telling you about. I had a rubber band fail on me. And I came back and I didn't know how to sew. So I reached out to somebody who did. And I said, hey, man, I want to bring this concept to life. And he goes, okay, tell me about it. And so I told him, I said, it's like a thing to like hold your sling so that it doesn't fall off.
Mm-hmm.
Like a sling, like a retention device.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, that's cool. He's like, I don't think it's going to sell. It sounds like a dumb as shit, but yeah, I'll build it for you. So I built the Gen 1. The first Gen 1 is actually sitting upstairs. I'll show it to you. And I built it and I released it. And it started to like get a little bit of traction. And then I started doing a little more further outreach. I called units like, hey, you want to T&E this? You know, give me feedback. And that feedback led to the Gen 2. And then the Gen 2 led to the Gen 3. And the Gen 3 was where we made our biggest kind of gains, where we realized it was more than just a sling retention device. We could also use it for holster use. And that's when the push kind of came out of nowhere. A lot of guys were taking this product that doesn't change the liability of the holster because it doesn't change anything on it. So mm-hmm. like if you have an issued Safari Land, you just take it, you put it on, it doesn't change the screws, and it's still within department needs,
mm-hmm.
but it's also still covered. You know, it's easy to take on and off. So it started to become very popular in law enforcement. Eventually I start selling to some agencies, to include a local one. Being MNPD, we do sell to some of the units there. And then it just kind of took off. So for about a good 3 years, the Gen 3 was just like, I was just turning them out. And then I started building other stuff. Not for the purposes of what people asked for, just because I wanted to build stuff for myself. I kept saying, man, I have nowhere to like hide these things. Like the cuffs, my this, my that. Because we have such a unique job with my job. I said, I'm going to build these things. So it started with the placard, which is a deconfliction piece. Then it started with then it was the hush rig. Then it was our IWB pouch for cuffs and small radios. And like, we just started like kind of staying in our lane. I could build other things, but I like the EDC / low vis kind of realm because it just makes sense. It's an underrepresented market. And if you do build those things, I think you have a smaller audience. But also, no one's really catering to them too. Whereas, you know, when you're making chest rigs and plate carriers and stuff, everybody's doing those. And those are awesome things to make too. But I just like staying in the realm of our shop. So I started sewing. The Gen 1 pretty much took us to took us into the game. And then the Gen 3 is kind of where it kind of solidified us. So I have the Gen 4 is just recently released. The Gen 3 and 4 is sold globally. So I have customers overseas. I have customers throughout the U.S. It's been in conflict zones. It's been in videos. It's been on the news. I'll be watching the news like, oh, look at that guy getting, arrested. Oh, look, there's an SRC. It's fucking awesome. It's absolutely awesome. The other day with the riots in Union Square, there was a cop just wrestling and rolling around. And this SRC is getting the shit kicked out of it, but it doesn't move. And I'm like, oh, marketing opportunity. Let me let everyone know that's my product. So we have some fun. I get weird requests all the time. People be like, hey, can you make me this? Can you make me that? So that kind of what led to, let's do a sew shop. Mm-hmm. Let's do an open sew shop. So we started doing open sew. Come on in, bring your favorite beer and we'll sit and we'll build shit. I'm like, why not? You know, I think there's so many awesome people out there with great ideas, but there's no out for figuring out, how do I bring this thing to life?
Mm-hmm.
So you come into the shop, you show it to us. Okay, this is the direction I would go. These are the materials I would use. This is how I would get it done. What do you want to do with it? If it's something super cool, guess what? We got you 100%. If it's something that like, hey, man, this is like a one and done, mm-hmm. and we'll tell you.
Yeah.
Like, but you never know. I got laughed out of a military chat for offering my SOC-3. I remember saying, hey, is there any Air Force? I was in the Air Force at the time. Mm-hmm. I was in the reserves, Guard rather. And I offered it into this group, which was like senior mentors and all this other shit. And they like laughed me out of the group. And I'm like, one guy stepped up and said, hey, I know your products. I actually own blah, 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 blah. Hey, that's awesome. My unit would like it. So here I am many years later. And all those people were like, ah, that's a stupid idea. It's really not a stupid idea. It's pretty lucrative idea, to be honest with you. But that's kind of what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a lot of old, I think most of it's gone, but like the older crowd. That was like naysayers.
You
know, like kind of
you mentioned the 90s, and I remember the 90s when people were starting to transition from revolvers to semi-autos. And it was like, oh, there's no way there. You can't, you know, it's unreliable. And it's like, okay.
Well, it's different world.
Well, brother, I appreciate you having us up.
Yeah, thank you.
And
thank you.
Looking forward to it, man.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for coming.
And, yeah, thanks for having the protectors.
Please
here,
eat before you leave because you're still, like I said, you're in the best bar.
I need to find the best bagels.
Yeah, you're surrounded by it, my friend. Surrounded by it.